Good morning. I have a feeling the scripture reading this morning will be longer than the sermon, but that's okay. And there was much rejoicing. If it's your first time with us, we're thankful that you are here. And if it's not your first time with us, if you've been here a few times or a thousand times or more, we're thankful to have you with us again. It's good to be together, to worship God together, to sing praises to His name, and to be blessed through our fellowship, through our reading, through our communion, through our time spent with one another and our time spent with God. We're going to cover a lot of territory today. We're going to kind of summarize a lot of Exodus from about chapter 6 through chapter 14. Now, I promise we're not going to read the whole thing, but we are going to cover a lot of that territory. So you're welcome to follow along. I'll toss a couple of scripture references here and there, but they're not going to be on the slides this morning. So just enjoy. Between a rock and a hard place. Now, we have no idea what the etymology or the background is of that statement, but it evokes a specific image and tone, doesn't it? Between a rock and a hard place sounds pressing, uncomfortable, challenging. It defined it's a dilemma without an acceptable choice or alternative. And no matter which alternative is chosen, there will be pain and loss involved in that outcome. And if Israel had ever felt between a rock and a hard place, it was here at Pi-Hahiroth. For they were trapped between the sea of reeds before them and Pharaoh's advancing army behind them. There was nowhere to run and no place to hide. And so they cry out to God and then complain to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us here to the desert to die? What have you done by bringing us up out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, just leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." I want to go back and examine the story to this point. Because where we left things last week, Moses was arriving on the scene to deliver his people out of their slavery. But how did Israel get here, at this time and this place, for this reason? For last week, they were still slaves in Egypt. That story, the story of how they arrived to this place, is full of miraculous deeds, divine interventions, egotistical clashes, and amazing deliverance. When Moses returned to Egypt, he went first to the leaders of Israel to elicit their help. And when they heard the words of the Lord, and they saw Moses' signs, they believed and they worshiped. While the leaders were originally excited at the prospect of freedom, they also sent Moses and Aaron by themselves to confront Pharaoh. And when Moses speaks to Pharaoh, the only change that happens for the people of Israel is more work. Now the Israelites have to gather more straw in order to build the bricks that they need, but the quota of bricks will stay the same. And so when that happens, the Israelites become afraid and angry and resentful. And they curse Moses, and they do not listen to him because of their discouragement and their harsh labor. And so Moses wants to quit. His very first encounter with Pharaoh doesn't turn out the way that he hopes, and so he says, "I'm done." Yet God refuses to let him quit. Once again, God reminds Moses that he will be with him and that he will work through Moses and his words. Now, Moses complains of his faltering lips and says Pharaoh will never listen to him. And if we're to be fair, why should Pharaoh listen to Moses? For Pharaoh considered himself to be a god. He was the very personification of Ra, as well as a whole bunch of other gods like Horus and Osiris and Amun and others. He believed himself to be God incarnate on earth. Pharaoh was believed to have the power over life and death. He was the controller of the Nile River and the provider for all of his people. If you wanted good crops, then you prayed to Pharaoh. He was the upholder of Ma'at, which is an Egyptian word that stands for justice and order. And if Pharaoh was a god, then why in the world should he listen to a person like Moses? But God says a very impressive and strange thing in chapter 7, verse 1. Yahweh tells Moses, "See, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron will be your prophet." God is about to change the way that Pharaoh perceives Moses. He's going to make Moses his equal. Not because Moses is powerful or special or important, but because Yahweh is with him. And listen to what God says that he is going to do through Moses. This is in chapter 7, verse 2. You are to say everything I command you. And your brother Aaron is to tell Pharaoh to let the Israelites go out of his country. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And though I multiply my signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt, and with mighty acts of judgment, I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it. God is saying, this is all about me. I am about to do amazing things. And so, God begins to work. And through everything that happens in Exodus chapter 7 and forward, God is showing that he is greater than all of the supposed gods and goddesses of Egypt. He begins to show that their power is nothing in comparison to God's himself. And so God starts with 10 signs, or we call them 10 plagues, seeking to demonstrate to the Israelites and to the Egyptians and to Pharaoh that no one and nothing is greater than Yahweh. The Nile, the river of life for the Egyptians, turns into blood, but Pharaoh hardens his heart and will not let them go. So next, God sends frogs to spread across the entire country, and that sounds miserable. This morning, I opened the door, and as I reached down and touched the doorknob, there was a frog on it, and I screamed and jumped, and so did the frog, interestingly enough. And I thought, that's just one tiny toad sitting on my doorknob. Imagine stepping on these things and sitting on these things and finding them in all of your food everywhere that you go. They're in their homes and their sandals and their beds. And Pharaoh then asks for prayers and for release. And he says, if the frogs go, then you can go too. And so Moses prays and Pharaoh changes his mind, hardens his heart and does not let them go. So third come gnats. And they cover all the people in all the land, but Pharaoh hardens his heart and will not let them go. Then next come flies, and they cover the entire land of Egypt, but the land of Goshen is left alone, and all the Israelites are spared. And once again, Pharaoh says, if you pray to God and give me release, then you and your people can go. Moses does, it happens, and Pharaoh says, no, I've changed my mind again. Fifth, there's a plague on the livestock, but Pharaoh will not let them go. Sixth, boils come on the people, but still Pharaoh will not let them go. Seventh, he brings hail to destroy all the crops that remain, but still Pharaoh does not let them go. Are you seeing a theme here? Eighth, come locusts, and they take what little bit is left, but they still don't get to go. And then ninth comes darkness. A very assault on the power of Pharaoh, who's the controller of the sun himself. But still Pharaoh does not let them go. Each of these plagues is an assault on the pantheon of the Egyptian deities. They were a reminder that no god, no power, and definitely no Pharaoh can withstand the power and might of Yahweh. And then finally comes the one that distresses us the most. It's the death of the firstborn. And all across the land of Egypt, the firstborn children die. And that's hard for us to think about, but we also have to remember that Pharaoh has started with genocide at the beginning of Exodus. And God is showing, if you bring death, so can he. Pharaoh thought he was the controller of life and death. And Yahweh shows you have no power. And that night Israel celebrates their first Passover, a meal that comes to signify protection and power from God. And the very next morning, after these 10 signs, the Israelite slaves are free. They went to bed enslaved, they woke up emancipated. And not only that, but as they left Egypt, they asked the Egyptians, hey, can you give us some stuff? And the Egyptians, to hurry them on their way, begin to just open up their wallets and take the goods out of their home and throw them at the Israelites just to get them to leave faster. And so they start showering them with gold and jewels and jewelry and other gifts. And so, as the writer of Exodus tells us, they plunder the Egyptians. Now, this has been the experience of the people of Israel to this point. They've seen the way that God brought the plagues to the Egyptians. They saw Yahweh work in mighty ways. They saw God demonstrate the powerlessness of Pharaoh himself. They watched as God turns the whole system on its head. Their former captors and abusers give them gifts to leave. And they have to think, isn't God amazing? And they begin to travel towards the land of promise. And they have no idea where it is that they're going. But they trust that God and Moses will get them there. And then to their amazement, God continues to guide them. And as Sam read for us this morning, in front of the people of Israel stood a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day. And they always knew 24/7 that God was there with them. But then after a few days of going forward, suddenly they turn back and begin to retrace their steps. Now, for those of us who know the Exodus account, who know this story, we understand what's happening. For the writer of Exodus tells us this: the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi Hahiroth, near Migdol in the sea, and they are to encamp by the sea directly opposite Baal Zephon. Pharaoh will think the Israelites are wandering around in the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all of his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." And so the Israelites do this. Now we, as the readers of Exodus, know what's happening, but the Israelites don't. Are we lost, they might think? Did we take the wrong path? How could God, who did such great things, make such a wrong turn? And so now here they stand, between a rock and a hard place. Or maybe we should say between the sea and the army, with the seat of reeds in front and the advancing army of Pharaoh behind. And there's nowhere to run and no place to hide. And whatever choice they make from here on out will seemingly lead to their destruction. And out of fear, they cry out to God and complain to Moses, "Were there no graves left in Egypt for us to die in? Did you have to bring us all the way out here for us to die? It would have been better for us to stay than to come out here and die in the desert." And for those of us reading this story more than 3,300 years later, it's easy for us to judge. Where is their faith? And where is their trust? After all that they've seen and all that they've experienced, all that they know, why do they doubt in God? They had the signs and the plagues that to prove God is working. They could look down and see the rings on their fingers and the plunder in their wagons and think God was watching over us. They could look up and see the pillar of fire and the pillar of smoke anytime they wanted and to remind themselves, well, where is God? Well, he's right there. So why do they have such a difficult time trusting when they stand here before the sea? Trust. It's a very easy word to say, but it's incredibly difficult for us to do. Merriam-Webster defines trust as the belief that someone or something is reliable, good, honest, and effective. In essence, trust requires faith. It requires a relationship that exists between two or more people or things that have learned to depend on one another. And for many of us, trust is easy. We believe that people are essentially good and right and fair. But for others of us, we struggle to trust in other people. And sometimes that's based on our past experiences, things like abuse and neglect. Things like loss and hurt and betrayal can make it far more difficult for us to trust in other people. And sometimes that comes from our worldview, which colors our perceptions of others. Or sometimes it's the experiences of our race or our ethnicity or our gender or our age. But some of us find it very difficult to trust. Every few years, the Pew Research Forum conducts a survey called the Social Trust Survey, in which they attempt to gauge the levels of trust that are inherent in the culture around us. And the question they ask is this: generally speaking, would you say that most people can be trusted? or that you can't be too careful in dealing with other people. And in 2014, just 19% of people my age said that people could be trusted. Now, for the baby boomers in the room, 40% of you think people can be trusted, which is still less than half. They also note in this survey that people who feel vulnerable or disadvantaged for whatever reason tend to find it riskier to trust because they're less well-fortified to deal with the consequences of misplaced trust. Now, I want us to think about that for a second and let that sink in. Those who have had difficult experiences in life find it far harder to trust. Those from minority populations, those who feel vulnerable, those who have lived disadvantaged in society. Although Yahweh has been watching over the people of Israel and taking care of them to this point, the people of Israel have a history of abuse and neglect, betrayal, hurt, loss, and victimhood. They've been enslaved, and they have a subjugated mentality. Sure, Yahweh had led them out and liberated them, and they had a newfound freedom after a life of slavery. But these are people who are used to being told what to do. They didn't know any other way. They'd never had much in the way of hope in their lifetime. They've never had a cause for trust. So why should they do it now? But what I find amazing here is how Moses and God respond. They don't berate them for their lack of trust. They don't bemoan their lack of faith or criticize their inability to believe. Instead, it's a simple call to faith and a call to a deeper experience of God. And in chapter 14, verse 13, it says this, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm and see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today." And on the surface, that seems rather silly. Of course we are afraid. Do you not see the cloud of dust behind us of the army coming? But God calls them to trust. Don't fear. Stand firm and see. And to be honest, what other option do they have at this moment? But God is promising them deliverance. Another way to translate this word is salvation. When all seems lost, God provides a way out. Just trust. Don't fear. Stand firm and see what God will do. And Moses continues with this message from God. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only be still. And he does. Most of us in the room know this story, but God shows up. He parts the sea, and then he makes there to be no mud as the Israelites cross across. He confuses the army of Pharaoh and then gives his people safe passage. And then he allows Pharaoh's army to advance, and suddenly where there was no mud, suddenly now there is mud. And then the sea comes crashing in, and the army is swept away. And this is what the writer of Exodus tells us down in chapter 14, verse 31. And when the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. They learned to trust because they continued to experience the power of God and they could trust that God would be faithful to them. Now, I want to ask you a question this morning. How much do you trust God? Do you trust him with your life, your job, your relationships? Do you trust him with your money or your future? Do you trust in his goodness, his faithfulness, his kindness, his caring? Do you trust that God will do what he says he will do? And it's easy for us to sit here and to nod along and to at least agree with what it is I'm asking you to agree with. When things are going well, our life seems easy. When we're happy and healthy and well-fed, when we have all that we want, or at least we're content with what we have, then trust seems easy. But when life gets tough, how deep is your trust? When the doctor has bad news, when the phone rings in the middle of the night, when the police come knocking on the door, when your boss calls you into the office, How deep is your trust? For some of us, trust seems really easy. But for others in the room, simply talking about trust is incredibly uncomfortable. And it hits us close to home. I'm not sure if I'm trusting in God or not. Or maybe it's, you know what, I don't think I like God much right now, and I'm not sure I want to trust Him much right now. Whether or not trust is easy for you is okay. Because I want to remind you of something this morning. God is still faithful. When life seems easy, God is still faithful. When life seems impossible, God is still faithful. When all is going right, God is still faithful. When nothing seems like it ever goes right, God is still faithful. When the path ahead seems easy and clear, then God is still faithful. And when that path seems choked by obstacles and every hurdle imaginable, God is still faithful. What I love from this story is that God is right there with them. He's never left them. He is always out in front of them. And the same is true for us. Life serves as a trust laboratory. Now, it's not that we're caught in some sort of weird experiment gone awry, but rather it's that life is filled with joy and hope and wonder and beauty and excitement, as well as pain and sadness and loss and challenge. And the question is not whether or not we will ever experience hard times in our lives. The question is, how will we respond to them when we do? Will we respond with faith and trust, or will we give up in fear and despair? The Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin once famously said this, "Trust is good, but control is better." I really like that quote. It makes me feel good. It's trust is good, but being in control, that is better. Okay, now, none of you thought I would quote Lenin this morning. All right, let's be honest. But that speaks to our desire, right? We want to be in control. But a theologian by the name of Jürgen Moltmann once delivered a lecture about 10 years ago at Yale Divinity School, and he turns this quote on its head. He entitled his lecture, "Control is Good, but Trust is Better." And towards the end of his speech, Moltmann says this, "In biblical faith, trust in God doesn't mean safety and security as if we're still in our mother's womb. Biblical trust is not just when everything seems to be going right, God is always going to take care of us in the ways we think He should. Instead," he says, "it means, biblical trust means reliance on the coming of God, that God shows up." When life is easy, or when life is as difficult as you can imagine, in whom do you trust? We believe in a God who shows up. And some days that's a struggle for us. Let's be honest. But stories like this one, and stories like the ones we have in our lives, and the stories we could share with one another, remind us that God has worked and is working and will continue to work in the hearts and lives of His people, for He is a God who brings salvation and deliverance. And there's nothing that Israel can do to fight their way out of this situation. When they stand between the rock and the hard place, they simply are called to trust and to watch as God works. God brings salvation to His people. God shows up. And all we can do is simply stand and accept it and trust that God works. And God is worthy of our trust. If there's any way we can help you this morning, we want to do that. If you stand between a rock and a hard place, then we want to be there as God shows up. We want to walk with you and stand with you. If you are struggling to have trust right now, then we want to stop and to pray with you and to stand beside you. Or if you want to talk about how God has shown up in your life, then come up and do that, and we will rejoice with you. And if you need to know the salvation that God offers and provides, then we want to do that, for we have a God who is worthy of our trust and our hope and our life. If there's any way we can bless you this morning, we want to do that. come as we stand and as we sing together.